Okay, we'll next hear argument in docket number 23-1320, Activist Laboratories versus the United States. Okay. Mr. Carpenter, whenever you want to begin.
Thank you, Your Honor. And good morning. May it please the court. My name is Clint Carpenter. I represent the United States in this case. The decision below should be reversed because Actavis incurred litigation expenses at issue in the process of pursuing its acquisition of intangible capital assets, specifically the FDA approvals of its generic drugs before the branded name drug patents expired. The only reason that a paragraph 4 applicant like Actavis litigates these suits, the only reason to defend against the suits, the only reason to contest these infringement suits is to obtain that FDA approval that is effective before the patents expire.
What's the relevance of it being the only reason? That suggests motivation, and I thought your point was motivation doesn't matter.
Well, I think it's objectively the only reason. Not their subjective motivation for doing it, but there's no other consequence to the applicant.
Isn't the reason the generic defends itself in district court litigation is because they're sued by the branded patentee?
No, actually. Normally, in a normal infringement suit, sure, that would be the case. But here, nothing can happen to them as a result of this suit if they were, say, they were just to default or just to concede the suit and not participate. All that would happen was they would get an injunction prohibiting them from marketing their drug until the patents expire, and there would be an order telling the FDA that they can't issue approval with an effective date before the patents expire. The FDA couldn't do that anyway, if you lose the suit. But there's no risk of damages. I mean, the statute specifically prohibits granting damages here, and there's no damages because they haven't actually done anything infringing. I mean, they've committed this act of deemed infringement by virtue of submitting an ANDA with a paragraph 4 application. The Congress made that an act of deemed infringement that could trigger that allows the patent holders to sue. But there hasn't been any infringement.
Is your best argument for why we should treat expenses associated with defending against 271A claims versus those defending against 271E2 litigation?
Because the best argument is that there being 271A claims, no one's prosecuting it or defending it in pursuit of a capital asset. You know, the patent holders already have the patent. I mean, that's an intangible. But the defendant, their right to the patent isn't an issue in the case, and the defendant isn't trying to get a patent or get an FDA approval or anything. They're just trying to vindicate their pre-existing right to sell their product in regular patent litigation. In this case, though, in this 271E2 litigation, they are trying to obtain FDA approval, specifically before the patents expire. And Congress established a process in the Hatch-Waxman Act for applicants to get that pre-expiration approval. And as part of that process, they have to submit this paragraph 4 certification, which is an act of deemed infringement. They have to write a letter to the patent holders and basically say, hey, we infringed your patents, you know, you can sue us. And then if the patent holders do sue, they don't always, but if they do sue, the applicant has to defend that suit. If they don't, they can't get that approval before the patents expire. And so defending the suit in that case is part of the process that Congress set up for acquiring that intangible asset, the FDA approval.
Is there a case that's analogous to the facts here? I guess you're saying that they're trying to acquire an intangible government-granted license, approval of an ANDA,
yes,
earlier in time than they could have otherwise. And I'm trying to think, okay, is there another case where being able to acquire an acquisition earlier in time than you could otherwise by overcoming some hurdle is, in fact, something that ought to be capitalized rather than deducted? Is there a case That is something similar to this, where the timing of the acquisition matters?
I am not aware of a specific case that addresses that.
I'm only aware of Mylan.
But apart from that, which is that's the same issue here. Apart from that, I'm not aware of an analogous situation. I guess what I would say is that if you look at the regulation and you look at the examples, that process of pursuing standard for capitalization that's in the regulation, it's really broad. And it includes things that are purely optional. There's an example that says that if you're acquiring an intangible and before you buy it, you get an independent appraisal, you pay someone for an independent appraisal, you have to capitalize that because it was part of the process. There's no law that says you have to get an independent appraisal before you buy an intangible. It might be the smart thing, but you don't have to.
Since you are aware of Mylan and we're all being aware of it, can you respond to the reasoning set forth there in the Third Circuit decision?
Yeah. I think the problem with the Mylan decision is that the court was looking at they sort of defined the issue correctly, but then looked at it the wrong way. And so that manifested in a couple ways. I think first, they talked about that litigation doesn't facilitate the FDA's approval. But that's not our position. Certainly it doesn't, they don't benefit from being sued. It doesn't help them get the approval that they get sued. They'd rather not get sued. But if they are sued, defending that suit does facilitate the approval because they have to defend it. I mean, they have to defend it and they have to win or at least litigate it for 30 months if they want that pre-expiration
approval.
But
isn't that an important distinction? I imagine there's a lot of things that could happen in parallel to a generic company requesting FDA approval of their ANDA that the generic may have to do if other things happen, but we wouldn't say that those things facilitate the approval.
Well,
it's a separate approval process.
Well, in fact, though, in the Mylan case, the Third Circuit mentioned this in passing, but this issue wasn't appealed. The tax court held that the attorney's fees that they paid to pay their attorneys to write those letters to the patent holders, they did have to capitalize those.
Because that's within the generic's control, and it's absolutely 100% all the time required if you want to pursue a Paragraph 4 approval of an ANDA. Right?
It is, but
very different than the litigation, which they cannot bring themselves. They have to wait for the patentee to decide whether to bring it, and the approval can happen almost regardless of what happens in the district court litigation under certain scenarios.
Under certain scenarios.
For example, if it takes 31 months for the district court to get an opinion out.
Correct. Now, if they then lose after that 30 months, the FDA actually revokes the approval.
Right, but they did.
They had it at some point. That's true. I think we would say that that's a distinction, but it doesn't really make it different. Because the issue here is when you are sued, you have to capitalize the expenses of litigating that. They may not get sued. That's not in their control. But it's no less optional to defend a suit when you are sued than it is to write the letters. You have to do all of those things if you want this pre-expiration approval.
Were you going to catalog some other problems you see in Judge Jordan's opinion?
Yes. And I know Judge Jordan is well respected by this panel, and he hears a lot of patent cases. And so certainly, I wouldn't tell him or you about the patent side of things, but on the tax side, he misunderstood some things. There's also the issue that there's the 30-month approval. The Mylan court viewed that as, the litigation doesn't have to be resolved in order to get approval, or it doesn't necessarily, because it can go on for 30 months. But again, the issue is it does have to be defended against. There could be a question whether you have to capitalize the expenses that you paid for after that 30-month period. If you got the FDA approval at 30 months, do you have to capitalize the stuff for the rest of the litigation? That maybe is a closer question. We don't have that here. I don't think you need to decide that. But there could be some argument there. But certainly up to the 30 months, you had to do that in order to get that approval, whether or not the litigation has to be resolved. The process that matters under the regulation is the taxpayer's process for pursuing the asset. It's not just the FDA's process. The FDA's process is the scientific and technical things, but by law, even if they satisfy all of the technical requirements for approval, the FDA cannot give them effective approval if they get sued until at least 30 months has passed or the litigation is resolved before then.
Can you give us the definition of the intangible asset in your opinion here?
The intangible asset is the government-granted right to market or sell a generic drug. I think the parties sort of disagreed somewhat about whether that the right to sell it before the patents expire, is that part of the asset, or is that just sort of a separate timing thing? In our view, we think the better view is that it's part of the asset because it's a different right. You have the government granted right.
Is your definition of the asset and the transaction at issue, does it have the time element of paragraph 4 embedded in it, or does it not?
I think it doesn't. It doesn't have to. I think we win either way. I think it's easier for us if you include the timing aspect in it. But even if you don't, if you just say that it's just purely FDA approval,
Maybe more specifically, effective approval.
Yeah, I'm sorry. Yes, it has to be effective approval. You don't receive any government granted right until it becomes effective. So yes, if the asset is just effective FDA approval, regardless.
The patent litigation is a roadblock to effective approval. So they have to basically fight it out through the patent litigation before they get effective approval?
I think it's a roadblock. It's part of the process that Congress set out. That you have to do it. You have to expose yourself to being sued, and if you get sued, you've got to defend, and you either have to win or at least litigate it for 30 months.
Do you agree the outcome here is the same whether we go with just right to your regulation or if we do this origin of the claim analysis?
Yeah, I think we think it's the same. We think the regulation is controlling.
In other words, they rise and fall together. You couldn't imagine winning on one and losing on the other.
I don't see how that could happen, but if your honors were to disagree, I think we would say the regulation's controlling.
Did either side argue for the sort of hybrid test that the Court of Federal Claims used?
No. I think Actavis argued for origin of the claim. We argued for the regulation. There was some IRS guidance that used sort of this hybrid approach, although it came out to the opposite conclusion. And I think that's where the claims court got.
And our court has applied the origin of the claim test in numerous cases after Woodward, have we not?
Sure. Oh, absolutely.
And were we wrong to do that?
No. I think, certainly not until 2004. This regulation didn't come about until 2004. So origin of the claim definitely was controlling up to that point. I don't think there's any. Actavis didn't cite any, and I'm not aware of any cases where origin of the claim was applied where something after 2004 was at issue. Some of the cases happened after 2004. But again, we don't think that the outcome really, it doesn't make a difference. The standard is almost the same.
Are you contending that we need to reach whether origin of the claim test is still applicable post-2004?
No, I don't think it's I think if you were to conclude that we win under origin of, or we win under the regulation, the government wins under the regulation, but the government loses under origin of the claim, then I think you'd have to decide that. But otherwise, you don't need to decide that.
In all other scenarios, we would not have to decide that question. If you lose
all
under
other
both,
scenarios
under
that
both,
I've thought of, yes.
It does require a win by you for. That isn't a necessary prerequisite.
That is a necessary prerequisite, and
it is
certainly,
not a necessary
I don't mean to suggest that's a foregone conclusion, but yes, that's right.
You're into your rebuttal.
Oh, I'm in my rebuttal. Well, then I should stop talking. And
okay,
say
very
the rest
good.
For rebuttal.
Let's hear from the other
Thank
side.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the Court. Kevin Martin on behalf of activists. With me, I have my colleague, David Zimmer. Your Honor, at the bottom, the government's arguing.
Is it activists or Actavis?
So I think I've heard my client say activists. I'm beginning to doubt myself now after the last 15 minutes, but I'm fairly certain it's activists.
Sorry to use up your time. Keep going.
So at bottom, the government's arguing that generic drug companies, alone among all patent infringement defendants, should be denied the ability to deduct their defense costs. It's elevating form over substance. It's seeking disparate treatment of similarly situated taxpayers. The tax court, the claims court, the Third Circuit were all correct to reject that approach.
So the Supreme Court has described, and we probably have too, the Hatch-Waxman regime as involving generic and defilers who make paragraph 4 certifications as provoking or inviting litigation, and have talked about the intricate relationship between the FDA process and the district court litigation. Isn't that what has been said? Isn't that how courts have described it? And doesn't that have implications here for whether your expenses should be capitalized?
I mean, so that language is out there, certainly, Judge Stark, but we would answer that question no. The origin of the claim test is the test that applies here. And what the Supreme Court has said for the origin of the claim test is that you don't look at the consequences for the taxpayer of losing the case. You look at what the origin of the claim is. What's the origin and character of the claim? We think the best precedent from this court, for example, on that question is the court's decision in Glaxo versus Novopharm, where this court made clear at some length that really, while there's the artificial act of infringement, once you get into it, 271A litigation and 271E2 litigation are about the same thing. They're an effort by the patent holder to keep another company from competing with it, from engaging
in... But the only reason that litigation is happening before you launch your product is because you want to launch your product prior to the expiration of the patent.
And there's really nothing that distinguishes that, Your Honor, from a 271A case. In any other industry, even in pharmaceuticals, if you were not a generic company but a company seeking NDAs, you are looking to launch before a patent has expired.
What if the Hatch-Waxman Act was written differently? What if it said, after the generic manufacturer files the ANDA and does a paragraph 4 certification, the generic manufacturer has to file a DJ action to seek a declaration from the district court that the patents are either invalid or are not infringed by the generic manufacturer's ANDA. Then what happens?
That would, in fact, be a very different case, Judge Chen, because
you would agree that the litigation expenses there would have to be capitalized.
I don't know that I would agree. I mean, one of the major...
Why wouldn't you agree?
I think the reason I would not agree is that you're still in the universe where the first act was taken by the branded drug company, which included the patents in the Orange Book, essentially asserting that these are patents which
reasonably could be asserted. But Congress basically demanded in my version of the Hatch-Waxman Act that it is you, the generic manufacturer, that has to go to court, that has to file the claim, and in order to get any kind of ultimate FDA approval.
That makes it closer to the example that Judge Stark was talking about that was discussed in the Third Circuit's decision with the notice letters, where that's actually required by the statute as an integral component of the application itself. So I do think it's a different case, but it's closer to the line of having to be capitalized. But what all the courts who've looked at this situation...
Would it fit within the Treasury regulation?
It may very well in that situation fit within the Treasury regulation. What really distinguishes this case, though, is that it's within the control of the branded drug company, whether to sue or not. They don't always...
Yeah, but just sticking with my little hypothetical, we've said DJ actions are just mirror images of garden variety patent infringement civil actions. So if we are in a territory that a DJ action by the generic manufacturer would be understood as, an expense in pursuit of an acquisition of an intangible, then it seems like then the mirror image would also apply.
That's why I think it's relevant that you only are in this universe if patents have been listed by the branded drug company in the Orange Book as patents that reasonably could be asserted against a generic applicant. And I don't want to get into the constitutional issues here too, but I think even to have for Congress to create that cause of action, you'd have to have an actual controversy between the parties. And for a DJ action, I think you would have to show that there was some credible threat by the branded drug company to bring the action. And so it's still ultimately a claim by the branded, even though it's in the form of a DJ action, it's still ultimately a claim that is a claim by the branded drug company. We think our patent covers your product. And you're bringing it as a DJ, but as in the Urquhart case from the Third Circuit, which was a DJ action, that should not matter for tax purposes that it's a DJ action. What should really matter is what is the true essence of this claim? And it's in effect a tort claim by the brand.
So you did argue that the origin of the claim test is what's applicable here. Do you think a different result would be reached under the regulation?
Not at all, Judge Cunningham. Again, we have multiple statements by the government that there's no meaningful difference between the two standards. The examples of litigation which appear in the regulation are origin of the claim cases. Obviously, they have this example 4 under subsection 4. That's the Woodward case. They also, in subsection 5, have the American Stores case. That's an origin of the claim test case. When you look at the notice of proposed rulemaking, I'm not sure how I didn't notice this before, but the notice of proposed rulemaking cites the Woodward case in introducing the need for transaction costs to be capitalized. That's the one case they cite. It also cites the A. Staley case from the Seventh Circuit, which is an origin of the claim case. So there's nothing in the regulation itself which suggests that there was a desire to move away from the origin of the claim test. Right, it just says consider all the facts and circumstances.
Do you have a response on the definition of the intangible asset? Do you have a response to what opposing counsel said?
And we would agree that the intangible asset is ultimately a granted ANDA. Where we disagree is that the timing component matters. An ANDA that's granted today is not a different ANDA than an ANDA that's granted a week from today. What happens, and I think as your honors all know, what happens under the Hatch-Waxman Act is that the FDA is reviewing your application, and it will, at some point, grant you either a tentative or a final, or it denies it, but let's stick with grants. If you lose the litigation, they don't actually, in my understanding, revoke the ANDA. What they do is convert it to a tentative ANDA. It's still approved, it's just the question becomes, when will it actually be issued to you? And there are lots, I think Judge Stark may have asked a question along these lines, there are lots of reasons why an ANDA might be issued today as opposed to a month from now. Right, they're reviewing, among other things, what facility you plan on manufacturing the drug in, making sure that facility is up to snuff and will produce the drug in a safe fashion. And maybe there's an environmental issue with that plant. So then FDA is waiting to see, well, what will resolve that environmental issue? Have you cleaned that up yet?
There's no evidence in our record that the FDA treats paragraph 4. And is any differently in terms of how quickly they process them than, say, a paragraph 3 or even an NDA, is there?
Not that I'm aware of, Your Honor. And again, going back to the legislation, this was discussed below. It's somewhere in the record, and I apologize for not having the site. But there was evidence from the legislative history of the Hatch-Waxman Act that they settled on the 30-month stay period because the assumption was that's about how long it takes to review an ANDA. So the timing component here was really just an effort by Congress to be more efficient, to make it more likely that you'll have generic drugs on the market, competing with branded drugs, bringing prices down. Congress certainly did not, we think, intend to change the tax treatment of generic drug companies to make it less favorable than it would have been before the Hatch-Waxman Act in an action brought under 271A pursuant to this court's precedent in Roach versus Bolar.
After you submitted Mylan, the government wrote us a letter, and they said, and I think this point was made today, the only reason a paragraph 4 applicant defends against a Hatch-Waxman suit is to obtain FDA approval that is effective prior to the patent expiration date. I think you have to agree that's true,
yep.
And doesn't that strongly support their view that these things are, again, they're entirely intertwined?
So we would agree it's true that that is the motive, but as the Supreme Court has said time and again in cases like Woodward and Gilmore, the very last thing you should be looking at is the subjective motivation of the defendant in the lawsuit. You're looking at the objective origin and character of the claim. The origin and character of the claim, it's a tort claim brought by a property owner seeking to protect its own business. Its character is identical to an action under 271A, and so it should not be treated differently. And the government has repeatedly acknowledged, not only in its briefing to this court, for example, in its reply, where it said that the two tests are not meaningfully different, but also in the legal memoranda, which came out prior to the litigation, where the government itself, on three separate occasions, said that you apply the origin of the claim test first. The origin of the claim test is the controlling test, And under that test, you do not look at exactly what Your Honor just pointed to.
The Third Circuit went with the regulation, though, right?
They did. I mean,
there was a footnote for origin of the claim, so I guess the Third Circuit goofed.
Methodologically, I think that the way the Court of Claims approached it is the proper way. That's the way that, again, that the government approached it in all of its memoranda before the litigation started. At the end of the day, the outcome is no different because the two tests are the same. As the government has said, the origin of the claim test gets subsumed into the regulation, and the outcome is the same. The regulation itself, nowhere in the notice of proposed rulemaking, nowhere in the regulation, is there a suggestion that while Woodward said ignore subjective motivation, the regulation was intended to make subjective motivation paramount, which is basically what their argument boils down to. It would have been really strange for the agency to cite Woodward in the notice of proposed rulemaking, make one of the examples Woodward, if they intended to depart from the core holding of Woodward, which is it's the objective origin of the claim which matters, not the consequences for the taxpayer of losing the case.
I think you said the Court of Federal Claims got the analysis, the analytical framework right. Do you mean the sort of hybrid two-part test that the Court of Federal Claims here applied?
Right. I think the best way to approach this would be to look at the origin of the claim test, which is the test that has governed litigation costs for decades, answer the question under the origin of the claim test, look at the regulation and say, is there anything in this regulation which requires a different outcome here? And the answer should be, in most cases, no. It might be the case that in the regulation, there's a carve-out, right? So maybe the origin of the claim test says you would capitalize.
Is this what you're outlining? Is that the process that you think the Court of Federal Claims went through here? Or is this yet another framework that you would propose?
No, I think this is what the Court of Claims did. It's what we suggested doing in our briefing to the Court of Federal Claims. This is our argument and our complaint, and it's the way that the government approached it in its 2011, 2014, and 2015 legal memoranda that preceded this litigation kicking off.
I don't know if this hypothetical has any implications, but let me ask you anyway. Oftentimes in a district court and a case, there's multiple filers, and the generics view one another as opponents as much as they view the branded patentee as an opponent. And sometimes a lot of time can be spent dealing with arguments amongst the generics that might have competing claim construction positions. Some might file motions to dismiss that others don't. There might be discovery disputes between them or protective order disputes between them. From your perspective, do the litigation expenses that are incurred when there's multiple paragraph four filers that are expended on attacking one another as opposed to attacking the branded, are they treated just the same, or are there any implications for how those are treated for the dispute we have in front of us?
Yeah, I think under the government's theory, then you might have to start parsing issues like that. From our perspective, you don't, because they're all deductible at the end of the day. Most large complex litigations will have those kinds of subsidiary issues, discovery fights, disputes among defendants. These sorts of disputes are helping put my kids through college, so I appreciate their existence. From our view, those shouldn't matter. It's all part of the tort litigation.
From your perspective, is it potentially yet another problem with the government's view here that taxpayers may have to really parse their own legal fees and say which fees were incurred fighting another generic versus which were incurred fighting the patent?
I think that's a fair point, Judge Stark. There was a similar argument they made below and haven't really been advancing now in appeal, which was that the possibility of getting generic exclusivity is a factor that supports capitalization. Now, not every generic will get generic exclusivity, and their position is that all generic defendants need to capitalize, and I think that might be why they've dropped it now in appeal. But you have the potential of exclusivity. You might lose it if another first filer gets out ahead of you. There could be forfeiture events. So these are very complex issues, and that's why we think the Supreme Court, in cases like Woodward and Gilmore, has said do not focus on the consequences of the case, on the fortunes of the defendant. Really just drill into, is this claim part of the acquisition process? And if it's not a case like Woodward where you actually had to figure out what the price of the asset was so the sale could occur, then you don't require capitalization.
Okay.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, Mr. Martin.
3 minutes for Mr. Carpenter.
Thank you, Your Honors. I think I'll start with the end first. I don't think that there wouldn't be any need to sort of parse different pieces of the litigation. All of the defense of the suit is occurring in the process of pursuing the acquisition of the asset. Now, there may be disagreements among different defendants, different applicants, but the defense of the suit is still all occurring in that process of pursuing the effective FDA approval. Judge Chen, your point about a DJ action, I think this really is a mirror image, and I think Congress could have done what you did, and they probably wisely said, well, no, let's do it the other way, and that way the patent holders could decide if they care enough or if they want to dispute this. But that illustrates why it shouldn't matter who sues who. We certainly don't read Woodward or any of the case law to suggest that both sides have to their expenses have to be treated identically. That Woodward certainly doesn't say that. If you look at Woodward, the plaintiff had to capitalize its expenses because it incurred these costs in the process of acquiring this stock. Well, the other side, they didn't have to capitalize their expenses because they were trying to acquire stock. They weren't trying to acquire stock. Now, as a point of tax law, they probably did have to capitalize their expenses, but it was for a different reason that there's a rule that you have to generally capitalize costs incurred in selling capital assets. But they didn't have to capitalize them for the same reason. If you look at American Stores, it's the same situation. Under activists' reading, in American Stores, the defendant's expenses wouldn't have to have been capitalized because the plaintiff didn't have to capitalize their expenses. That's not how tax law works, really, in any scenario that I'm aware of. You focus on the circumstances in which the taxpayer acquired the expenses. And in most litigation, the general capitalization rules are going to apply in a way that most of the time both sides can either deduct them, or occasionally both sides will have to capitalize, like in Woodward, although in that case it was for different reasons. But there's no special rule of capitalization for patent cases or for any other kind of case. It's the same rule. If you incur under the origin of the claim, if the origin of the claim litigated is in the process of acquisition, under the regulation,
Can you cite any example of anyone else's patent litigation expenses that are not deductible other than generic paragraph 4 filers?
No, and I certainly don't dispute that ordinarily, in the 271A, that they are deductible, but it's the reason that matters. The reason they're deductible is not because there's something special about patent litigation, but because in ordinary patent litigation, neither side is trying to acquire a capital asset. And so there's nothing to capitalize in those cases. In cases where you have a fight over who owns a patent, for example, then there does have to be capitalization. I'm out of time. Thank you, Your Honors. We ask that the decision below be reversed.
Okay. Thank you very much. The case is submitted.